Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by HelloFresh. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code SiriusPod30.
You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 138. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Today I'm speaking with BJ Mendelson about online privacy, data, all kinds of cool stuff. And also, he's got just a really interesting story. He went viral in 1998. Didn't even know that was possible, but he's going to tell us about that. He also quickly amassed 1 million Twitter followers for a weird reason, which you'll find out. But also, it wasn't really quite what you would expect. On top of that, he's also got some interesting insight into the darker side of some Silicon Valley origin stories. Seems like there's potentially a lot of whitewashing that goes on in the stories these companies tell about themselves. So lots to talk about. Then, of course, we also got to talk privacy, Cambridge Analytica, that kind of thing. With those teasers aside, though, I want to tell you about something very important. I will be speaking to NOSHA, that's the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association, and that's going to be on May 19th, coming right up. So if you're anywhere near the New Orleans area, please come out and see me or email me or something if you want to find out more. But you can go to NOSHA, NOSHA.info, and that has more details. If you're anywhere near that area, I'd love to see you. I'm going to be giving a very, what I think is a very interesting talk, and I'm super excited. So that's NOSHA.info, NOSHA.info. Please check it out if you're anywhere near. All right, with that said, let's get over to my conversation with BJ Mendelson. BJ, how are you doing?
I'm well. I'm fighting a cold, so if you hear me snuffle or sniffle a little bit, you'll know what that's from. But yeah, otherwise, I'm great.
That's podcasting for you. It's like half the time.
<That's right.
laughs> Well, you've got a book that I think right around this time after, you know, in the wake of Cambridge Analytica and just God knows how many other stories, you have a book called Social Media is Bullshit. So that's going to be very interesting to talk about. And then you've also, you've got a new book in the works. Is that right? Or you just published one?
So I just published a new one called Privacy and How We Get It Back. Mm. And the audio edition is called The End of Privacy. And the reason for that is the audio edition has more dick jokes in it. And so I wanted to have like this clear line of demarcation. Okay, if you want like a quick serious read or somewhat serious, then you can get it in print as Privacy and How You Get It Back. And if you want the dick jokes, you can get it on Audible at The End of Privacy.
Awesome. So before we get to that, though, I'm curious what your background is. How did you become interested in this and what's your expertise?
So I tend to fall ass backwards into things. So I had a comedy website in high school go viral back in like 1998 before going viral.
Wow.
Was like a thing.
Oh, tell me about that. What did it mean to go viral at that time even?
It was kind of crazy because I didn't know. It was originally just me and a friend of mine who I had to change his name in the book because he's a doctor now. He didn't want his patients to know that he and I had this comedy website. It was just like us poking fun at the high school. And for whatever reason, it just spread from the high school kids to their parents to the local media. And then to like the larger surrounding media. So at that point, like the big radio station in my area was 92.7 WRRV, and they were talking about us on their morning show.
Wow.
That's funny. So from there, just people start, you know, companies like Sears and Ogilvy and Mather and Sprint and a few other ones. just sort of came to me and said, hey, you seem to understand this internet thing. How does it work? So, yeah, I guess I just sort of made a career of doing that. I understood viral marketing without necessarily knowing what it was until much later. Yeah. And I had that advantage of watching in 2008, all these people kind of come out of the woodwork and explain the way social media works. I'm kind of like, yo, that's not how this stuff works at all. And so that's what the book was about. The book isn't saying, you know, the platforms are bad. The book is saying just, you know, you've got a lot of charlatans out there who are kind of peddling this bad advice in their own financial self-interest as opposed to actually helping people out.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's so much of that self-help or, you know, manual on how to do X, how to be a podcaster, how to bit a bit. And it's like, I think it's a good way to make $20 because it's just telling you a bunch of stuff you could figure out on Google in 5 seconds. And it's not necessarily like an actual in-depth anything. But it has such a great feeling of like, well, I'm going to start this project. Okay, I'm going to buy the book because that's what you got to do. But it's like so often they're bullshit. But in what way was social media bullshit back then that you're or what people's explanation of it, I guess?
Back then, they were convinced that the number of followers you had mattered. So I was lucky in that I was on Twitter as far back as 2007. So they used to promote my account. And through a crazy set of circumstances, I had applied to be a secretary at Twitter. Didn't get the job, but then told them, hey, I'm going to go and do like this nationwide breast cancer awareness tour. You guys used to promote my account. Could you promote it again? So they rolled out this suggested user list. And there was like 28, 30 celebrities. And at the very bottom was me. And so if you signed up for Twitter back then, they didn't give you a choice. Like you auto-followed all these people.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, at one point I had about 1 million followers. I was right behind Ashton Kutcher, Oprah, and CNN, which was kind of crazy in its own right. But even then I kind of saw, okay, when I tweet something, people didn't necessarily act on it. So I'll give you a couple of examples. When I did the breast cancer tour, I teamed up with Dunkin' Donuts. And every time I would go to a Dunkin' Donuts, they would tweet out and say, hey, Brandon and Amanda. Amanda is my now ex-wife who was with me on the tour. They're going to be at the Dunkin' Donuts in Washington, D.C. by the Verizon Center. Come say hi. You could share their stories about breast cancer, what it means for your family, and what you want others to know. And nobody came out. And this is, you know, with close to 1 million followers, if not 1 million. And then later we did a fundraiser where we're like, all right, well, if like a fraction of these people donate money, then okay, we'll donate money to not-for-profits. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
And do you want to guess how much money we raised?
Somewhere in the neighborhood of zero?
Oh, yeah. So you're the closest. So I've done this question on a lot of interviews. You were the closest. So the answer is $1. And the wow. $1 was from Amanda, bless her soul, for donating. And so I found really early on that there was something weird with what the social media marketers were saying. And then by a twist of circumstances, this Marine Corps colonel calls me up after the tour is over, and he's like, hey, could you do that again for my not-for-profit, which is called Wounded Warrior Family Support? And they're now on their seventh, I think it might even be the eighth year of doing my tour, which is now called the High Five Tour. And the reason why that was successful and the breast cancer tour wasn't was because I went back to what I know works. So I knew that, you know, it's all about PR. It's all about big visuals. So the colonel set like the world record for the most high fives given at the Philadelphia Independence Day Parade. And he was driving around this custom Shelby Mustang that people could come out and sign to thank the troops. And so that became a big success. And I realized then that it can't just be me who has this story. Like, it has to be other people who've tried what the Gary Vaynerchuks and Seth Godins and Chris Bergens and Guy Kawasaki's have said and found that it doesn't work the way that they say it does. And so I did a tremendous amount of research. You know, it's a quarter of the manuscript for social media is bullshit. It's all interviews and end notes. And that's what brought that book together.
Wow, that's such an interesting story. So you really do have that experience from all the way back in 98 when I didn't even know you could go viral.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people forget. Like, there was the $1 million website where this kid was like selling little pixels for a dollar or whatever it was, and there was 1 million pixels, and he sold it out. He became like one of the web's earliest millionaires. And then Netscape is like an early example of something that was being given away for free, that was also creeping on people, by the way. Like a lot of people don't know that Netscape was one of the first to like collect data on people and sell it. But that's another example of something that went viral on the web back before we called it viral.
Yeah. So I guess, do we want to transition over to what your focus is on now? Which is,
yeah, I mean, it's all the same, and, really.
Yeah, okay, sure.
So just by way of background, I've written 3 books. The first one was Social Media is Bullshit. The second one was Ghostwritten for a Tech Company Executive. I don't know when or if that's ever coming out, but it was basically about like how engineers in Silicon Valley, they cheat to become these multi-billion dollar success stories. Like, you know, Airbnb's story isn't what they tell you in the book that's about Airbnb. You know, they actually hired a noted spammer and spammed the shit out of people. And then not only did they do that, but they also found a way to more or less break Craigslist and kind of push in all of these updates from their site and get the traffic coming back to them. So that's what that book was about. And then the new one, new, quote unquote, because I started in 2015, was about privacy and what really, like, what's going on in the news right now. That was what I was talking about in the book. I couldn't have timed it any better. So what you hear about in the news about like these data breaches and why they happen, why Facebook takes advantage of you and why they're reluctant to change, those are all things that I talked about. So it's really one like consistent theme throughout all the books.
Yeah, definitely. Do you want to, I just assumed that Airbnb was a pretty good concept and that like I have all kinds of friends who talk about using it and stuff. So in what way were they, what do you mean that they're not really what they're saying? Or I guess I don't understand that part.
Sure. So it means definitely a great company. Full disclosure, you know, they wanted me to do consulting for them. So I know people there and I'm not looking to bash employees, but they're, if you read any of the origin stories about Airbnb that's on the web or in the books, there's a bunch of books that have come out recently that's detailing like these unicorns and their stories. Airbnb was kind of like, oh, you know, we're a scrappy upstart. We were broke and we scrapped this money together and we did publicity stunts. Like, I don't know if anyone remembers this, but during the 2008 election, they had cereal boxes. And one was like Captain McCain Crunch and the other was like Barack Obama O's. I don't know if that was the actual names, but that was like their big story. Was we did this stunt. We were air bed and breakfast and then people loved us because it is a good product. I'm not disputing that. But they edited out this whole part about the CTO being a notorious spammer and in fact being on a watch list of people who had broken spam laws and, you know, were not supposed to be hired because of some of the practice that they did. And one of the things they did early on to grow was basically spam the crap out of people. And that's also something that Facebook did too. Like, it's not, this behavior isn't limited to Airbnb. Most of the quote unquote unicorns that people talk about have all done stuff like this. You know, like, my favorite part of the Facebook story that's not in a social network is how they bought a overseas email scraper. And, you know, it was a company called Octazen that no one really knew about. And from there, they just took all those emails and then spammed it. And then said, hey, you should go and check out Facebook. And like, we never talk about that. But that's what that book, that second ghostwritten book was about. Airbnb is just one of the examples of that.
Oh, okay. So it's not, it's people trying to get a start or get noticed or get, you know, that first step of into the spotlight. It's not necessarily like the company you're saying.
Yeah. It's so how I think it's framed in the book, and he's probably changed it since then again, cause I don't know. I handed him the manuscript. I don't know what happened after. But we were kind of saying, you know, it's not that these tactics are illegal, but they're kind of shady. And so we wanted to point them out cause we wanted to point out that there was a little bit of an ethics gap, which is something that I expand on in the next book, which is privacy and how we get it back. You know, because if you dangle $1 billion in front of a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds, they're not going to think about your privacy.
Yeah.
You know, they're just going to think, how can I get that $1 billion and how can I get more of it? And so any sort of like ethics goes right out the window if it means collecting more and more of your data to turn that money into a profit.
Right. So then do you want to talk about Facebook? Because I mean, that's what it's been it's probably been a month by now, but Zuckerberg testifying, I found highly frustrating. I don't know about you. I don't have the background you have, but what was so frustrating is, I mean, A, he's a robot, so that's, I mean, whatever. I don't right. want to be racist toward robots, but he's he is Data from
he really Star Trek. Is. That was bizarre. My favorite meme that came out of that yeah. was the picture of him as Data.
Data, but not as likable. Anyway, what frustrated me was it really made me notice, and this is more the political angle of it, and you can talk more about the you know, the data and the technical angle, but it really made me, for one, notice how important it is, as if we shouldn't have known this already, but how important it is to elect good people and smart people and not just buy into bullshit, not just elect people that you want to have a beer with. Elect someone right. who's going to do the research to actually ask a question that makes sense of this tech mogul, you know, who's got all of our data, you know, like the questions the senators were asking were like, so do I turn the router off and then on or right, on and then right. just what? Somebody do some research or find a millennial or something to help you. But then the House actually, which was weird, the House of Representatives, they actually, I think they must have seen the bad news coverage that the Senate got, because they actually tried a little bit harder. So
they did.
That was what I observed, at least politically. Now, what about the actual technical privacy stuff going on? Do you want to break down yeah. kind of what you think about all that?
Well, sure. There's one thing I wanted to add on the political side was I was in touch with Senator Grassley's office. I was in touch with a number of the senators that were asking questions. Unfortunately, the information that comes into their offices about privacy is not great. Mm. I think that they, for whatever reason, just sort of went out there and winged it. But I did certainly try to get in touch with all of them and say, this is what's going on. Because that's why I did the privacy book. It's this small little thing that just sort of quickly outlines what's going on. So there's that. But the other issue that we have, and more on the technical data side, is that Facebook and Google, and you know, I don't want to just say Facebook because it's all of them, and we're being mm-hmm. honest. You know, it's Apple, it's Microsoft, it's Amazon, it's Twitter, it's Snapchat. They make their money by presenting this stuff as magic. And so when you see Zuckerberg come up and ask these ridiculous questions, he's able to just sort of skirt away without there any real consequences. And so what's frustrating to me is that the FTC did issue a dissent decree in 2011 that said, hey, Facebook, knock this shit off. We know what you're doing. Otherwise, we're going to fine you. And here we are in 2018 and no one, you know, they're still doing the same thing that they're doing. And in particular, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg saying, oh, you know, the company was started in my dorm
yeah,
room,
yeah.
as if that somehow excused the behavior. It really bothered me because there's no secret to what Facebook is. Facebook is just a repository of your stuff, you know, and they create these privacy in terms of use policies that nobody reads. And in people's defense, those things are designed not to be read. You know, they're deliberately designed to be impenetrable so that you just sort right. of go, yeah, 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 and click accept, and no one really knows what they're getting into. And so just, yeah, I think your point about not, you know, not having a millennial present to grill them is really what bothered me most about that, because there's really nothing sophisticated about Facebook. It's just there's no teeth to the regulation in the United States. And even in overseas, you know, they found a loophole for the GDPR laws that are going to go into effect this month, where they now have all the European users as if they're managed by the American side of the company.
Okay, can you explain the GD, whatever you just sure. said? What is that?
Basically, it's their universal privacy law that okay. governs, this is how your data is collected. This is what
is
you must consent for.
Is it more strict than here?
Yes.
Okay.
It's absolutely more strict. You can be fined upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars for a data breach. You must give the user consent to opt in to the sort of data practices that Facebook has. So instead of just going into Facebook and having them do whatever, you actually have to say, that's my data. You can't have it anymore. Mm-hmm. And Facebook has to give you the right to delete it. So it's called the right to be forgotten. And so that's over in the European Union. And over in Canada, they're starting to clone the GDPR legislation. But here in the United States, because we have a system, you know, it's not meant to be a political statement, but we have a system that's always been geared more towards the wealthy, you know, as opposed to everyone else. So there's really no one at the wheel to say, all right, well, we want GDPR in the United States. So every time that we've talked about a data privacy bill of rights, like under the Obama administration, the tech companies come in and just dump millions of dollars
yeah.
into lobbying. Google, Facebook, and Amazon are some of the biggest, and even Apple, are some of the biggest lobbying firms or lobbying companies in the country now. And people don't realize that. So, you know, our system is not really set up to provide that sort of control of your data. And so that's what the book is about. The book is just saying, this is what's going on. This is why this issue hasn't been fixed. And here's like the three or four things you can do to fix it.
So you're saying your book is along the lines of the individual. Okay, here, you know, don't rely on whatever the hell is happening in Congress.
Yeah.
Here's what you can do. And is it, I mean, is it more than just, here's what you can do, turn your computer and your phone off. You know, is there a way to salvage some sort of social media presence and experience without having your data compromised in the way that you're outlining?
Well, the short answer is no. Like, oh, it's general data protection regulation, by the way, like for people that want to know what GDPR stands for. So what I describe in the book is it's like this sliding scale of privacy, right? So there's always going to be people that are just going to use Facebook and not care. And that's fine. But one of the things I propose is there's no reason why for $8 a month, $9 a month, you couldn't have a version of Facebook that doesn't creep on you. Mm-hmm. Like there's no technological impediment for them to roll that out. In fact, Sheryl Sandberg, after those hearings were over, has started to say the only way to get your privacy protected is if you pay for it. So I think that they're starting to kind of pave the way towards you're going to have to pay to not be creeped on. There's other things people could do. You know, I always tell them to cover up their web camera, and which sounds rudimentary, but no one does it.
That's a difference. Now we're branching out into something else. So
yes.
A second ago, we were talking about, you know, Facebook and the fact that they're tracking you. Well, actually, we should cover the basics. In what ways are they creeping on you? Can you outline that?
Sure. So it doesn't matter if you use Facebook or not, they have a profile on you. And the reason why is that if you use the site, and let's say you have a friend that doesn't use Facebook, then they've got they have the world's largest data set of faces. That's something people don't realize. And so they already sort of know what these people look like who don't use Facebook, and they can infer from the data they've collected from you who that person is. And then they can go to like an Experian or Equifax or any of the large credit bureaus or some other companies out there and purchase that data to fill in the blanks. So even if you are not a Facebook user, they have what's called a shadow profile of you. So there's that, right? There's that aspect. And then there's the aspect of people that use Facebook are just volunteering information. The reason why I roll all these things together as, you know, cover your web camera and also you have no privacy when you use social media is, to me, it's all one problem. To me, I house it all under, right now, there's really no guardrail for how your data is collected. And that's, you know, if we look at local grocery stores, they do the same. I don't want to let them off the hook either. You know, your data is constantly being collected and sold without your consent and without your knowledge, and people are turning a profit on it. So to me, it's really one issue.
But I guess what is going into that file they have? I mean, because I think if someone makes a file on me, that could mean something or it could be nothing. And so I don't, just saying those words, well, they have a profile on you or they have a whatever on you. Even if you're not on Facebook, I mean, well, what does that contain? And like, why is that valuable to me or harmful to me?
The short answer is everything. That's not in the book. I kind of lay out like there's 12 or 13 different sets of data that they can collect, something like your social security number, your driver's license, your mailing address. You know, those are like the big ones. But they also know your taste preferences. In some cases, these sites might know your sexuality before you've come out and talk to your family.
Yeah, I think I heard about some of the ways that they're able to predict things that.
So, yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound reductive or basic when I say everything, but it's quite literally if there's data to collect on you, then they have it.
And so I'll give an example. I mean, my address has never been anywhere near Facebook,
but they have it.
Like but my address is obviously on Amazon or something. And so is it just because I'm using Amazon as well, they're able to somehow get at that data, or how are they doing
it? So how it works is there's a lot of companies that just package and sell data from these companies to other companies. And the reason why your data is so valuable in the first place is that 19% of America's GDPR is tied up in the advertising and marketing business. And so to them right now, they've been sold basically a big bill of goods saying, you know, Google and Facebook are the things you want to invest your money on because they have all this data, and we can target this, and we can micro target this segment of customers. And so there's this obsession which fuels the value of your data. So your data on its own really isn't worth that much. What makes it worth something, and the reason why they have your address when you've never given it to them, is because the advertising business has said, we want that data. We want to be able to target these customers, even though it's not clear that this targeting actually works.
That's interesting. I'm just curious about the address part specifically, because like, how does that even, so what are they even using that for? Just like, okay, geographically, you're building a profile.
For the most part, it could just be they want your zip code more than anything else. So okay. Your street address might not matter, but the zip code does.
I see.
So that they can turn to an advertiser and say, we have a high concentration of people that live in the 10950 zip code. And they have, based on what other data points they've collected on you, they could say, well, we know Thomas likes NPR. And so there's a high concentration of people that like NPR that are in the zip code that you can target.
So it's offering these micro-targeting opportunities. Yes. Okay. What part of that goes over the line for you? I mean, is there, I guess if you could categorize stuff into legal but shady, you know, or totally legal because we just signed an agreement that says, sure, you can do that, versus, I mean, do you have any knowledge of like the Cambridge Analytica kind of thing where it's like, no, that's definitely shouldn't be legal or must be illegal, you know, like what range is this all? Is this all legal because we haven't done a good job regulating it because Congress doesn't know what the hell it is or doesn't care?
Yes, that's the short answer. Okay. Is that it's not.
I got there eventually. Yeah.
It's not illegal, but I call it in the book creepy.
Okay.
Because they're doing it, and they really. So another example of creepiness, right? And I use this example in the privacy book, is that there was a reporter in Germany, because she falls under the EU regulation, she's able to request the data that's been collected on her from sites like Tinder, and so Tinder, which you figure would just be, you know, your likes and dislikes as the data they collect, sent her 800 pages worth of data.
Wow.
And in the 800 pages was like,
I don't even think there's 800 pages of things about me. But yeah, anyway, go on.
Well, yeah, but that's the crazy thing, is you figure they would just collect your likes and dislikes, but they're collecting your SMS messages, your Facebook likes and dislikes. They're collecting messages that you've sent on Facebook, other data that's been collected off of your phone, other data that's been sold to them from some of these third-party data brokers. So, yeah, I mean, again, I don't want to sound reductive when I say everything, but even a company like Tinder has like 800 pages on this one reporter in Germany, and that wasn't all the data. They actually withheld some of the data because they didn't want her to know what their likability score is. So when you use Tinder, they actually match and show you people based on how likable they think you are. Mm. And so they withheld stuff like that from her as well. So it's creepy, is really what I try to drive home. And what was crazy to me is that like the Cambridge Analytica thing, they weren't doing anything. How do I want to phrase this? Like, it's shocking when we see it. And a lot of Americans are upset about the outcome of the 2016 election. So it makes for a great story. But what Cambridge Analytica and the researchers who they got the data from were doing is not abnormal.
Yeah.
In fact, if you...
No, I agree. I think people did really want... I think there is certainly a segment of people who want there to be some nefarious reason Trump won. And right. There may be nefarious things, but I think that I agree with you that, you know, and my impression as well is, well, people were already doing this. However, that's not to say, though, that it wasn't wrong what they did, because
that's
they
right.
lied,
that's
they right. stole the data based on false pretenses. And if, you know, if the Trump administration or if the Trump campaign or if anybody knew or was a party to that, I would want to know, you know.
Oh, for sure. And yeah. I think that there should be legal consequences. So I don't want to sound like I'm excusing
okay.
it.
Yeah, just want to make sure to clarify, because I think there has been a lot of muddle on that issue.
Oh, for sure. But the thing I want to point out is that anyone can take a trip down memory lane through Google and search the term growth hacking and growth hacking success stories and like all of that nonsense that was bubbled up between 2014 and 2017. And that's what Cambridge Analytica did, was you had this entire group of people that were downloading all of this information off of Facebook and downloading all this information off of LinkedIn and then finding creepy ways to target those people in order to grow their companies and become unicorns, become these multi-billion-dollar success stories. So the good thing and the bad thing of Cambridge Analytica is the bad thing is that it's not illegal, but it should be. The good thing is that it finally gave us a reason to talk about growth hacking and why these people. Because
what's growth hacking?
I'm telling you,
is that when you say growth hacking, is that an annoying dork term for people who want a shortcut to a $1 billion company or something?
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's like social media, right? Like, social media is just a new term to describe stuff that's been on the web since 1994. We just came up with a cute term for it. And growth hacking was sort of the same deal where it was just...
Sorry, no offense. I consider myself a dork as well, but I just was like growth hacking. Everything has to have a fancy, like, you mean just trying to get... Anyway, sorry.
No, you know what? It's a tangent, but it's...
There's so much like Silicon Valley like language that you're just like, all right, okay.
Well, it's all bullshit. Yeah. You know, and that's what I tried to hit on in the first book was it's in their benefit to present this stuff as magic, right? Yeah. So if we say social media marketing, there's a lot of people that don't know what that means. If you say growth hacking, there's a lot of people who don't know what that means and will buy those books because they want to find out more. My favorite thing, though, is the head guy that was pushing that nonsense. He was doing an interview on a marketing blog, and they're like, what's the difference between marketing and growth hacking? And there's this long pause, and finally he goes, it's just marketing done better. It's just like, fuck you, man. Like, come on. Awesome. So that's a long way of saying is that everything that we've talked about so far is just these tech companies and the people that enable them know that there's a financial benefit to cladding this stuff in secrecy.
Right.
And the less we know about it, the more they can get away with
being creepy. It's like the cloud all over again.
Exactly.
What's the cloud? It's just a hard drive somewhere. That's all everything is.
Yeah. You know what's crazy is that the cloud is something that dates back to 1965.
Oh, wow.
It's not even new technology. There was a patent for it by Western Union back in the 60s. Jeez, where they were like, this is how things will work in the future.
Oh, wow. Okay. That seems really ahead of its time, but okay. Hey, everyone, I've got to interrupt and remind you that today's episode is brought to you by HelloFresh. If you haven't tried it before, HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can cook, eat, and enjoy. And bottom line, that's my favorite part about HelloFresh is the pre-measured ingredients, and it's everything you need. I hate food waste. It is one of my biggest pet peeves, and this allows you to just use the things you need in the proportions that you need. It's all neatly labeled and packaged. I love it. One of the big benefits of HelloFresh is how easy it is. And in fact, each week there's a 20-minute meal on the classic menu for when you don't really have more time than that. I love the nights when we have HelloFresh because I know and my wife knows that dinner is just solved for that particular night. I mean, we don't have to worry about, are we going to spend too much on some unhealthy stuff somewhere? No, it's all done. HelloFresh has delivered it. And we always know it's going to be really easy, really fun, and it's going to be something new. You can get out of your comfort zone by trying something new. There's always another ingredient that I've never tried or another recipe that I would never think to make myself. That's one of the coolest parts of HelloFresh. I have to say, still one of my favorite recipes that I've ever had was the cherry drizzled pork chops. It was so delicious. I love that contrast and the sweetness with the pork. It's really good. So if you'd like to try it for yourself, and I recommend you do, I've got a good deal. It's $30 off your first week of HelloFresh at HelloFresh.com/SeriousPod30. That's HelloFresh.com/SeriousPod30 for $30 off your first week. All right, back over to the interview. My thought I had was, A, somebody needs to do something about this. Like, there needs to be regulation. There needs to be regulation. And then when I see the questioning that went on in Congress, I think, right. Well, these are the people that are going to be doing the regulating. Like, I don't know if that's going to work. Like, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Now, I would hope they would have, you know, more staff that would, you know, actually write a good bill. But what is the solution? How are those people going to give us regulation that's going to do anything?
So I'm a little bit of a historian. You know, I was working on a PhD in American history. I haven't finished it yet, but I tell you that to point out that whenever we have change in America, it's always come through increments. And more often than not, it's driven by what happens on the state level. And we've seen that with serious issues like slavery, and we've seen mm-hmm. that with less serious issues throughout our history. So I honestly think that the federal government won't do anything until the states start to come in and say, you know what, if you live in New York State, here is the data Bill of Rights that... And we have that, like the Attorney General and Eric Schneiderman has been pushing like a data Bill of Rights. And over in Washington, they have an office that's set up and dedicated towards managing the privacy for the people of Seattle. And so that's the solution, is that we'll have things like, even in New York City right now, there's a law that passed that said If you're discriminated against by an algorithm because of all this data that's been collected, you could appeal that, because there's a huge issue. There's a huge social justice issue right now involving the collection of data and using it against people who have historically been discriminated against. And so that's where we'll see the changes. And so if anyone's listening to this, I know it sounds corny. I know it sounds like Schoolhouse Rock, but it really makes all the difference of, on the local level and the state level, contacting your representatives and saying, yeah, you know, I don't know what's going on in the federal level and it doesn't matter, but in my home state, I think we should have laws protecting my data.
Right. So laboratories of democracy, you say.
Yes, exactly.
But ultimately, though, while I do see what you're saying, and I hope that states do that, because I agree, you know, a lot of the things I talk about over on my legal podcast involves so many of the cases are, yes, there was a state law, and then, you know, it gets to the Supreme Court because it's challenged and it goes one way or the other. And then that's a precedent for everybody to be like, oh, OK, maybe this is a good idea. But like with something like this, how much can a state do, I guess, because these companies, you know, it's the internet.
Yeah, so just a couple of quick things. So I do think that, you know, obviously the issue isn't as major as something like slavery or discrimination, but there are long-term consequences.
Yeah.
And we are seeing that now, where people are discriminated against based on the data that's been collected, and algorithms are making decisions on these people that they have no idea.
Right.
And that, you know, that data is coming from what you put in on Facebook and what you put in on social media. So there are consequences to this. The other thing is, you know, on the state level, yeah, the short answer is yes. And the reason why I say yes is because during the dot-com bubble, the New York State Attorney General's office was very active in prosecuting a lot of the companies that scams people out of their money. I think of like Stanley Media as my favorite example, where the guy basically bilked Stanley and everyone out of hundreds of millions of dollars. But under California law, they were able to prosecute him and put him in jail. And so the big issue is that there's no teeth to any of these things right now. And all I'm really advocating for is the addition of some teeth. So if you are a company like SunTrust Bank and you had a data breach, there should be financial consequences for not securing your data properly. And that's something that could be done on the state level in the state that SunTrust Bank resides in. You know, like, so there's one avenue to protect your data, because that's where a lot of stuff comes from too, is a black market for different data points about people. So
right.
I haven't really even
touched on that, because there's so many of these hacks where they don't tell us, but then it eventually comes out and it's like, well, okay, yeah, we knew in 2015 that we were hacked and all your data was compromised, but now we're going to tell you, you know. So that's another component of it we didn't even touch on, which is securing data properly, I guess. But even, is there such a thing as being able to secure the data enough to where it could never be hacked?
I think so. I mean, anything that can be hacked will be hacked, or could be hacked, I should say. So, I mean, there's always that possibility. But I think that it's convenient for the companies to kind of say that and be like, oh, it's going to be hacked anyway.
Oh,
and
I see.
Yeah, you know, and then, like, so my favorite two examples was Sony, during the infamous Sony hack. The reason why that hack was as bad as it was is they had a folder on a desktop that was labeled passwords. And so once they broke into the system, that's all they needed. They just needed that one folder. Man. It's like, come on, guys. That's something they tell you in middle school not to do, right? Like they tell you to, you know, keep your password safe. And so, like, that's honestly the level that a lot of multimillion dollar companies operate on when it comes to securing your data.
Yeah, there's always a weak link. Like, there's just some 65-year-old man that doesn't know shit about this and then keeps a passwords folder.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened with Target. I mean, Target wasn't breached, but it was a third-party vendor who was using, like, Windows 95 or whatever it was. And so, you know, he didn't update the software, and the hacker got in, and he had access to Target's main system, and that's how they got it. So these things don't happen because, I mean, again, there are very sophisticated people out there that are hackers, but a lot of these hacks don't happen for that reason. They happen because the companies just don't invest the money in properly securing their stuff.
Wow. Okay. One thing I want to ask you is, if you were a congressperson, what would you have wanted to ask Mark Zuckerberg?
I don't think I would have asked him anything. I think I would have said, hey, you remember that FTC decree that you signed in 2011? Well, we're enforcing it.
Okay, what are some of the things you would have said, and then explain what you just said?
Sure. So the thing I would ask is it possible to offer a paid version of Facebook where my privacy is secure? That I think is a very simple question, and I know the answer is yes.
Right, right.
So, but I want him on the record saying it, because so far he hasn't said it. Sheryl Sandberg has said it. And one of the downsides of Sheryl Sandberg is that if you look at all of her interviews, she constantly contradicts herself.
Hmm.
Or she'll say one thing and then she'll flip off on it. My favorite example being that every small business in America should sign up for Facebook and have a Facebook page, because you will always be able to access your audience. And then, of course, later on saying, oh, hey, you know, things are getting really hectic. And so now in order for your stuff to be seen, you got to pay for it.
Yeah, the pages are just a joke now. I mean, I know that just from having my page, you know.
I deleted mine, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I had a page for the podcast. I barely even use it. I just don't even. They want to make you pay money to get to people. And even when you do, it doesn't do anything. Like nobody, it's all a joke. Anyway.
We haven't even talked about ad fraud. Just real quick.
Yeah, sure.
Over 60% of the traffic on the web is fake. And by fake, I just mean it's not human. It's bots. You know, it's a bot, yeah. Or it's a click farm or it's something like that. So a lot of the traffic that you do see driven from Facebook more often than not is either one, a bot, or two, it's coming from like Russia or Bangalore or something. And that's done because the click farms, it's in their interest to make it look like they're humans. And so they're constantly clicking on things that are unrelated to why they're actually on Facebook in the first place.
Mm.
And there's really no, as we saw with the Russians, there's really no policing of that, because it's not financially in Facebook's interest to police it. So that's a whole other thing. But what I would say about the FTC decree is essentially this. Back in 2011, going back a little further, I'm a big Obama fan, but probably the one fault of his administration, or one of the faults of the administration, is that he on numerous occasions gave Google and Facebook a pass on different things. So there was a couple times Google came up under DOJ investigation for being a monopoly, and both times they got some finger wagging and some naughty, don't do that again, Google, and then it got off the hook. And so Facebook signed a dissent decree in 2011 that said, look, we admit that what we were doing is wrong in terms of our data collection. We're going to fix it. We're going to do better. And if we don't do better, we will be responsible for paying these fines. And no one on the FTC side ever enforced it. So that's what I would probably spend most of my time talking to Mark Zuckerberg about. Is, you know, are you aware of this document? Is this your signature? Are you aware of this section that says we are working to improve our security? Do you feel your security is better than it was in 2011? Which the answer is going to be no. And so that's honestly what I would. Frustrating thing is we have these vehicles, right? We've got the Consumer Protection Board, which has been messed up by Trump, but we have the CPB, we do have the FTC, we do have the DOJ. There are things we can do against these tech companies. We just don't activate them the way that they should be.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I don't remember that mention. That would have been curious to hear the answer to that.
Me too.
What do you think is going to, I mean, what's frustrating is I still don't know that anything's going to actually happen as a result of this, unless maybe on the state level, as you've outlined. But do you think that Facebook could self-regulate? I mean, that seems to be what a lot of people just want them to do, so they don't have to worry about it, you know, so Congress doesn't have to actually research what the hell this stuff is. Is that possible? Can they? What are your thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think within a decade, the answer is yes, they'll have to. Sooner or later, the advertising money is going to stop flowing. And I think I don't know if this is too inside baseball, but WPP is the world's largest advertising agency. It used to be run by a guy named Martin Sorrell. And up until recently, WPP has been telling all their clients, like Procter & Gamble and blah, 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 to put money into Facebook and Google because you'll see great results. There's been a lot of rumblings in the advertising industry because of ad fraud, because of some of the issues we've talked about. There's also stuff like brand safety, where you know you've got ISIS videos and then a commercial for dish soap right next to the ISIS videos that go on. And so I think sooner or later the train will stop, the money train will stop, and they'll have to change their business model. And at that point, that's probably when they'll roll out and say, "Hey, for $9." We'll protect your data." So the answer is yes, sooner or later it will happen. I don't know if it'll happen fast enough, and I don't know if it'll happen fast enough to prevent some of the more social justice issues that I've mentioned, like the data collection and it being used. So really, you know, my whole thing with the privacy book, I'm giving the audiobook away for free, by the way. I've been giving away PDFs for free. Like, I don't really care if people buy it. I just want them to read it. Because I figure the more people that know what's happening, the more informed they can make their decisions about this stuff. And hopefully that'll lead to some kind of change before the advertising bubble pops.
I mean, I'm sure you're stealing their data somehow, but it's free. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no.
You just have to sign a click wrap agreement giving.
I've been giving away my cell phone number in all the interviews I've been doing. And so if people text me the word sheetrock, I send them a free copy, a free PDF of Social Media is Bullshit, and I'll get my number at the end of the interview.
Oh, cool.
But people have said, hey, what are you doing with this information? I said, nothing. I'm sending you the book, and then I delete you from my phone. Like, that's, I'm not collecting it or doing anything because I'm too lazy. Like, I don't have the ambition to go and text all of you.
So, and that's just one company, right? So what is Google going to do? You know, are we going to have a paid Google format where you that's another aspect of this. Facebook is, I think, justifiably getting a spotlight on them right now, but there's all kinds of other companies doing this. What do you think they're going to do?
I think it's going to be different. The data brokers, I think, will go under the right sort of regulation. We haven't even talked about this, but one of the things I put is that you should be compensated for your data.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into that then.
Okay. So it's everyone's popular subject, although it's old, like it's antique at this point. It goes back to about 2000. And so the basic concept is that it's like either Facebook A once a year would send you a check. It's not going to be for a lot of money. Like, it'll be for like $300 or whatever it is. And that'll be the agreement saying you could use Facebook and do whatever you want, and we will compensate you for your data every year as part of an annual license fee. And that's sort of the drawn linear approach. Which is that, you know, all the companies out there that collect your data would have to pay you some kind of license fee. And again, it's not a lot of money, but it establishes the principle that your data has value. I take it a little step further in that I think you should be able to control your data and buy and sell it. I know that over in Europe, I've talked with a lot of people over there who don't quite like that because they think that, you know, privacy is a human right and you shouldn't be selling your own human right. But I do feel that through, I'm not a big cryptocurrency guy, but I do think through something like that, we now have the technology in place where I can go to a site and say, hey, I don't want you to show me all these shitty advertisements. I want advertisements from Marvel. And Marvel might actually pay me for my time in exchange for showing only Marvel ads within the browser.
Well, but then, how is this going to work as a market? I mean, if they... So they're paying it already, you to advertise to you?
Yeah, like it already exists. There's a browser called Brave, and that's essentially what they do with a cryptocurrency called the Basic Attention Token, where a company can pay you for your time in exchange for showing their ads within the browser. You know, whether or not it's a marketplace
or an exchange. I was going to say, isn't that just a gamble or something for them?
Oh, sure. Like,
that they will get more out of you than they're giving you.
That's right. And I don't think there's any perfect solution at the moment.
Right.
I'm more of the belief that I want to try these things and I want to try all of them. You know, I want to try maybe paying $9 to Facebook in exchange for not being creeped on, or I want to try getting an annual license.
Well, yeah. Going back to that, I think paying for Facebook, I really think does make sense at this point because, yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I remember that forever was the viral bullshit that people
put. That's right.
Facebook is about to start charging for your thing. Post here if you don't. Oh, shut up. Like, there's no way. That and like the stupid contract people would do. Like, yeah. I do not allow you. And I had all this legalese that barely made sense. Like, retweet or, you know, what would it be? Share. And then, you know, that'll protect yourself as well. But at this point, I think we're in a different set of circumstances. Like before, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, it would have been like, well, that's absurd. No one's going to pay for this. And not only that, they were pretty mad. Like, how dare you think that I'm going to pay for Facebook? But now it's like, well, there's a lot of things we're paying for. You know, we're paying for Netflix. We're paying for Amazon Prime. And not only that, I think we're realizing the amount of stuff that goes into this, that amount of data that they have and the value there. And it might be to the point where you could pay for Facebook a few bucks a month and then So what would that just be like? A totally, would it be an ad free version or a?
Yes. So that's the pitch that I make in the book is like Netflix, you would pay them and in exchange, they wouldn't collect any of your data. Just very simple.
They wouldn't
simple.
Collect data, but would they?
Yeah, they wouldn't collect anything and then package and sell it. Like they could still show you ads if you turn it on. The whole point for me is that if you pay the $9, you have control mm-hmm. over your Facebook experience, as opposed to them sort of doing like this patchwork stuff that they're pushing out right now. Oh, look at us. We're making changes. You can clear your search history. Okay, great. Not a lot of people use Facebook search in the first place then. So
I think they said they were going to put in the ability to delete all of your data, right? Is that?
They've talked about it, but they haven't talked about the data that they're still collecting and packaging and selling okay. to other people. And that's sort of where the problem lies. So you can delete like all the stuff that you put into it is what they're saying, but you can't delete like their database of your face.
Okay.
For example. So there's, you know, it's one of those things where it sounds nice, but it's only a half measure. It's not a full measure.
Yeah. Another thing we haven't even talked about is the algorithms. We got all kinds of algorithms. I mean, it's been years and years since Facebook was even, and Twitter even just showed you Facebook and Twitter. Like it used to be, here, let me get on my rocking chair and like tell you right. tell you young 24-year-olds what are you, I don't know. It used to be that Facebook, you'd have a number of friends and anyone you were friends with, first off, there wasn't a news feed. Like you would just go to people's pages. But anyway,
right.
once they had the news feed, it was okay, everybody you're friends with and including all the pages you've liked, it'll show you whatever their posts are in chronological order. And I used to do this with, I think, Facebook back when, you know, I cared more about it and I was friends with people. I was like, I would scroll down, see everybody's stuff and essentially go to wherever I had seen before. So it was possible to scroll down and just get to like, okay, I've seen Facebook now. I've caught up as though it was like a newspaper I was reading. I've caught up on everybody's stories now. And maybe it's just because I have way more friends because of this podcast thing, but also there's no rhyme or reason to it. Like if I refresh Facebook right now, I won't even see any of the same things I just saw. Like it's right. it's not, I don't even understand how it works. I guess they just decide at random or there's a, you know, obviously the algorithm, the black box kind of thing where it's hard to know exactly what's happening, but I can refresh. I've done this on my phone before just for shits and giggles. Like I'll swipe down, do the swipe down refresh on my Facebook app. I could do it 10 times and it'll be 10 different feeds that have totally different stories that I wouldn't have seen in the other one. It's kind of creepy and it's annoying to me because it's like someone is deciding what I want to see, you know, and trying to like try these different things on me. It's like, I just want to see the people that I'm following, you know?
Right. And it's very easy to break that algorithm too. You know, one of my favorite things that came out of that testimony was Zuckerberg saying that even he wasn't sure how it worked, which is total bullshit. like it's not, first, the algorithm is not that complicated. It's just they want it to appear complicated. A fun game that people can play at home is that if you write the words congratulations or happy birthday or new job, you'll see that that post will get surfaced more than what if you post the link. Like if you post the link that goes out from Facebook, they bury it because they don't want anyone to leave.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, you know, they claim it's magic and they claim that they're doing it for one reason or another. But the whole reason why the algorithm's there in the first place is for them to serve you more ads at the end of the day. And that's true of Twitter as well. You know, Twitter back 10 years ago was awesome. You posted something, everyone saw it. Now you have no idea if anyone saw it. And that's very frustrating for marketers and just for people looking to get the word out about their stuff. So the big thing that I want to stress about the algorithm though is that it's not magic. Like it's, if it was very complicated, Facebook would not work properly. Like Facebook would take forever for it to load. So these systems in place are very easy to manipulate because they're dumb. And that's part of the reason why, you know, Russia was able to do what they do. So it's annoying for users, but then it's also bad for everyone else because we all think it's magic, but it's not.
Okay. Yeah. It's that makes sense to me. It's not magic. It's very self-interested stuff. Like you saying, it's just, if this will lead you away from the product, then we don't really want to show that.
Right. So, I mean, we've seen evolutions of it too. The trick used to be if you posted photos, your stuff would be surfaced more than if you had a text update, than if you posted multiple photos, and that would surface. Then if you posted video that was embedded within Facebook, remember, Facebook for a while there was clogged up with video because everyone figured out that the algorithm is really stupid. And the way to cheat it was to upload video. And so, my big takeaway to this, and the thing I want people to know, is that these things are not magic. It's a recipe that just says, if the user does this, then show this. And that thing is very easy to break by bad actors and sometimes marketers.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's frustrating. Is there an option? I feel like I've done this before, but I don't think it took, or that it eventually was undone. But for a while there was an option of like, no, just give me my goddamn, newsfeed and Twitter, especially Twitter. They started that a couple of years ago too. Twitter it held out for a while, which was just in order. Here are the things that were in your Twitter feed from other people you follow. And I think they got rid of that too. And no matter how many times I hit that little button of see less often, they don't give you, can you disable this goddamn thing? They don't give you that option. They give you, see less often. Yeah. I want to see 0% of the time. Just show me the tweets in order. But I don't know. It might be true that would get clogged up with stuff. And it might be that it's better to see more important tweets that you would otherwise miss. But do they even have the option to go back to the old fashioned way anymore?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they can turn that right on. That's the frustrating thing. I don't think so. Tell you, if you want to see more tweets from people you follow, just to engage with them more often, because that's what they do. Mm. Like, that's how their algorithm works. If you tweet with someone a lot, you will see their updates. If you maybe tweet them once, even though your friends offline, you will rarely have ever see their updates.
Yeah, I totally noticed that, especially on Facebook. It's like, if I comment on someone's thing, then all of a sudden the newsfeed's got a bunch of their stuff that wasn't there before.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want anyone to come away from this frustrated. I think change is coming. I think the more informed people are, they can check out the book at yourprivacybook.com.
Yeah.
The more informed they are, I do think that they can take steps to at least make it difficult for companies to creep on them. And I do think, on the local level, that maybe I'm being a little too optimistic, but I do think if you contact like the Attorney General's office or your state government, you could push for some kind of regulation.
Final question here. I do need to ask about the webcam thing, because I don't cover my webcam. Sure. What is the danger there? What's happening that people would need to cover their webcam?
It's more a philosophy of if it can be hacked, it will eventually be hacked, or it could be hacked. And so back in the days of Edward Snowden, remember him, he was talking about how the NSA was taking like sexy pictures of a lot of women through the webcam and then passing the photos around their office. So there was that initially had came out, and he has his webcam recovered. Mark Zuckerberg notably also has his webcam covered for that reason. So it's just one of those things where if you have a persistent internet connection and a camera connected to it, if you want to make yourself feel a little safer, you can cover it up with a piece of tape or post-it note.
You got any other tips or advice or anything? I know people should read the book, and of course the links will be in the show notes and all that. But anything else people should do? Obvious things that people should do but aren't doing.
Yeah, so covering up your camera. The most obvious thing that people don't do that they could do is keep their passwords offline in a notebook instead of storing it online. I know that sounds really simplistic, but a lot of people will, do what Sony did, where they have a folder with all their passwords.
What do you think of password managers? Are those
They have also been subject to hacks and breaches. So are they more secure than other things? Sure. But if we're operating under the philosophy that anything that can be hacked will be hacked eventually, then I prefer the notebook. I know it's a little bit of a pain in the ass, but I think that also encourages people, because you should change your password once a year. Unless you're the victim of a data breach, in which case you should change it immediately.
Yeah.
But by keeping it in a notebook, I think it's easier to go, it's time to cross this off and put in a new one.
Right. And then there's, of course, like, don't use the same password for everything and use complex passwords.
Yeah, well, don't make yourself crazy either. I think that there's a bit of bad advice that's come out over the years where you need some like 18-character password with like exclamation marks and at symbols and hashtags and all that. I think that you can have just a secure password if it's something like random horse battery staple.
Yeah, I love that. That was there's a comic. Yeah, that was brilliant. I absolutely love that.
And that's where I got it from. I cite him in the book. And so that to me is, you know, if you come up with something like that's crazy and obscure like that, it's almost as secure as having some.
Right. People were, I think so. The logic, just to explain to people, is that like we think because we're stupid humans, somebody along the line thought, oh, if I put a dollar sign in the password or, you know, some symbol, then that won't be guessed. But it's like, well, okay, if someone's just trying to, what's the phrase when they're just trying to hard, you know, random guess or whatever. What is that phrase? Brute force. Like if they're just trying to brute force your password and they're using random characters, it doesn't really, like putting $1 sign in it is a lot less valuable than just making it a long but memorable phrase, because they're not going to be guessing horse, carriage, you know, so whatever you just said, like Pony Express, like just a string of letters. If they're just brute forcing random characters, the longer it is, the better. But you're saying don't go too long. Is there a sweet spot?
Yeah, don't make yourself crazy. Like, if it's something you can remember, that's great. So random horse, battery, staple is something you can remember. It's long, but it's just something that you can picture visually is what he was talking about. Randall Monroe is who we're talking about, who's the author of XKCD. So if it's something that you can remember through a mnemonic device or through pictures, I think that's perfect.
Excellent. All right. Anything else before we call it an interview? Any other tips?
Yeah. Well, let me give out my number.
Sure.
So people can text me the word sheetrock. It's spelled exactly as it sounds. Sheetrock to 646-331-8341. That's 646-331-8341. And I will send you a free PDF copy.
They just have to send you their social security and address, right?
Well, I mean, as much information as you want to share, right? So right. Far, everyone's been on their best behavior, I'm happy to say.
Yeah.
Yeah,
how many dick pics have you gotten?
None yet, thankfully. Well,
I hope my audience won't be the audience that breaks that streak for you, but you never know. There may be some troll out there. All right, well, that's very interesting stuff. And blast your social media, BJ. Are you even on? Did you quit all that? So, or you do Twitter? Do you do Facebook?
I don't actively use them. What I do use Twitter for is if you like professional wrestling and comic books. I do maintain the Twitter account that's just based on that. And the only reason why is because that community, the comic book community in particular, is very active on Twitter. So
right.
I do publish comic books. So I do maintain the Twitter presence for that reason.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I do a similar thing on these. I mean, I'm just, you know, we didn't really talk about this, but you know, I don't click on anything. Like, there's got to be a way to use Facebook and Twitter in a way that doesn't compromise you. But I mean, it sounds like no matter what, they've got all this data on you. So maybe not. I don't know. Okay. Anyway,
once you pay for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's super cool. Thank you so much for your time and breaking that down for us. And yeah, check out that book, everybody. Text him or, you know, there'll be links as well in the show notes. And BJ, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm sure we barely scratched the surface, but I had a great time with BJ answering some of my novice questions about internet privacy. And also a lot of that history was fascinating. I want to give you one more reminder to go to Nosha.info to check out my upcoming talk for the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association on May 19th. Please come out. All right. As usual, I'll see you next week. I'm going to be having the regular 2 bonus episodes this month, and I'm thinking I might want to talk about the intellectual dork web. That might be kind of fun. We'll see. As of now, that's something I want to talk about because I'm getting a kick out of it. And, you know, you have to laugh about it because otherwise it's so frustrating. But either way, I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.